Hello there. Today's Friday, December 27th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, North Korea promised the U.S. a so-called Christmas gift, which so far has not surfaced.
North Korea has set the deadline. It does seem like they are bound to enforce that in some way. Otherwise, they'd lose credibility.
Changes are coming to leadership at Britain's Buckingham Palace. Also ahead, Billie Eilish is getting another award, but this time it is not for music. It's all on today's International Edition. North Korea may not have delivered a so-called Christmas gift to the United States, at least not on Christmas Day, but U.S.-North Korea tensions appear far from resolved as Pyongyang's end-of-year deadline for nuclear talks approaches. VOA correspondent Bill Gallo joins us from Seoul for an update. Bill, so far nothing? Are officials still concerned about the threat coming to fruition?
This threat originated early in December. It was at the end of a North Korean state media editorial. It warned of a Christmas gift for the United States. It didn't say what the gift was. It didn't say when the gift would come. It really didn't say much at all. However, it sort of became a dominant media narrative, I'd say, as it relates to North Korea throughout the month. People came to expect it to be a ICBM or perhaps another kind of longer-range missile launch. That is not without merit. North Korea had given several signs that it was preparing to conduct a missile launch. However, as you mentioned, Christmas Day passed without anything at all, really. There were not only not any reported weapons tests, North Korean state media were pretty much silent. There were no big provocations or you know, threats or criticisms at all of the United States. So people here are just kind of waiting to see what, if anything, the Christmas gift will be.
Are officials saying anything about their concern level, if they still think something might happen, or do they think it was just bluster? What, from that perspective, what are you hearing?
U.S. officials are saying that they are maintaining a state of readiness, sort of using typical language to say that they are watching closely. But they say it's no more than usual, but it's clear, according to private aviation trackers, that there is much more activity in the skies above South Korea, I should stipulate, as it relates to U.S. reconnaissance planes, drones, things like that, watching for a possible missile launch. There was actually a report last night in Japanese media that North Korea had conducted a big missile launch, possibly an ICBM launch, and that it had landed somewhere near Japan. That report was retracted minutes later. It was a real embarrassment for the news agency, NHK. It got a lot of people worked up. That turned out not to be true.
North Korea's self-imposed deadline to the U.S., the end of this year, to start nuclear talks and really telling the U.S. to make concessions or lift sanctions, etc. What about this deadline? Is that the next thing that U.S. officials are likely waiting to see what happens?
Yeah, the deadline, the end-of-year deadline that North Korea has set is really the next thing that everyone is watching. And there are two possible events that will likely give us a good indication of what North Korea intends to do. Sometime before the end of the year, North Korea's ruling party is going to have a big meeting where they will likely announce foreign and domestic policy decisions. And then, of course, Kim Jong-un is going to give his New Year's Day speech. Last year in that speech, he warned of a new way if the nuclear talks remain stalled. It's not clear they've made any progress. It sure seems like they haven't made any progress, so we could actually get to find out what that new way actually is. But yes, North Korea has set the deadline. It does seem like they are sort of bound to enforce that in some way. Otherwise, they'd lose credibility. So again, we're all waiting to find out what the details may be and what happens after the deadline, but that seems to be the next big event on the calendar.
All right. That is VOA correspondent Bill Gallo in Seoul, South Korea. Thank you for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. A magnitude 5.1 quake has struck near Iran's Bushehr nuclear plant. Japan will send a warship and aircraft to the Middle East to protect its vessels. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu claims a huge win in his Likud party leadership race. And U.S. stocks rally to new records as the NASDAQ ends above 9,000 for the first time ever. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Riot police stormed into shopping malls for a third day of Christmas protests in Hong Kong Thursday and detained a number of people after masked protesters roamed through shops and disrupted businesses. Their actions were part of a six-month anti-government movement to pressure the authorities to meet their demands. They include universal suffrage and an independent investigation into what protesters say has been police brutality. The anti-government movement in Hong Kong, sparked by a controversial extradition law, is showing no signs of abating. Journalist Verna Yu in Hong Kong talked about it with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson about these latest protests.
The current wave of protests started on Christmas Eve. While they are in smaller scale, i.e. they've been happening in various locations in Hong Kong, mainly in shopping centers and shopping districts. There has been a break for several weeks when we had relative calm compared with mid-November. And this time, people were responding to online calls for shopping protests. And the intention of the protesters is to make a scene and make a point through the shopping malls. They were chanting slogans such as Liberate Hong Kong, Revolution of Our Time. They were calling for an independent investigation into police brutality throughout the past 6 months in the anti-government protests. They are smaller scale protests than some of the really huge ones. This time, people want to make the point to say that we're causing, trying to hurt the business scene in Hong Kong, because Christmas time is traditionally a time when local businesses, hotels, shops are making lots of money.
What has been the economic effect of these protests then?
They really have kind of caused a lot of disruption to shoppers, because yesterday on Christmas Day and also the day before Christmas Eve, there were a lot of protesters in Mong Kok, and then police threw tear gas and severely beat protesters and passers-by. And really, a lot of the shops closed early, and we saw a similar pattern across in Hong Kong, in Causeway Bay and also Kowloon Bay as well. Today, we also saw police rushing into some of the shopping malls after mass protesters roamed through the malls shouting slogans. Really, I think for a lot of the shoppers, it's a pretty off-putting experience. And for the shops themselves, I mean, a lot of them simply have to close early. So I think this is wreaking some sort of havoc in Hong Kong.
Now, are more protests expected this week over this holiday period?
There's an organized protest on New Year Day, January the 1st. And this one has been organized by a local group called Civil Human Rights Front, and they have applied for a permit from the police. So, yes, we are expecting another big one. But the difference between that one and the ones we saw in the past few days is that the one that's been organized by this group is expecting a large turnout if they get police permission. Usually they attract the more peaceful crowd, including old people and families with young children. Whereas in the past few days, these informal protests that kind of sprung up here and there and everywhere tend to be kind of joined by a younger, more militant type of protesters.
It was Verna Yu in Hong Kong speaking with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson. The past year has seen a series of protests, not just in Hong Kong, but all over, from Chile to Sudan to Iran. In more than a dozen countries, citizens have been taking to the streets to air grievances, and many have gotten results. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir looks at a year of discontent.
In France, protesters put on their yellow vests and demanded better pay and an end to rising prices. In Sudan, the people brought down the 40-year regime of a genocidal dictator. In Haiti, they demanded the president's resignation and the prosecution of corrupt officials. And in Hong Kong, demonstrators started by standing up to the Chinese authorities over an extradition law and expanded their demands to include more democracy.
The older generations have failed tackling the biggest crisis humanity has ever faced.
Even school children have taken to the streets, demanding that adults take better care of the planet. In these countries and on the streets of Iraq, Lebanon, Ecuador, Iran, and elsewhere, citizens are saying enough and demanding a change to business as usual. The UN Secretary General has called on governments to listen to the real problems of their people.
It is clear that there is a growing deficit of trust between people and political establishments and rising threats to the social contract. And the world is also wrestling with the negative impacts of globalization and new technologies, which have increased inequalities within societies.
In response, some governments have tried to address grievances, while others use a heavy hand to try to keep power. In Iraq and Iran, hundreds of protesters have been killed by aggressive security forces. While protesters have been overwhelmingly peaceful, some in France, Chile, Ecuador, Bolivia, and Hong Kong have vandalized and looted property.
They have a right to peacefully protest. Governments, unfortunately, have been, in many cases, using excessive force, arresting people arbitrarily, sometimes even killing them, murdering them. That is illegal. The authorities who are responsible for the decisions and the killings should be held accountable, but also protesters need to behave responsibly.
Experts say protesters are less afraid.
The main thing that we see in many of these places is the break of the fear barrier. People are now unafraid to go out in the street and criticize these politicians, something in the past used to be taboo.
Diwashi says in many cases it is now the politicians who fear the power of the people. Much of that power comes from organizing through social media, which is both a powerful tool and a vulnerability as governments cut communication networks.
Governments have realized that internet shutdowns are a great way to make it difficult for protesters to organize, but we've also seen that they still organize. You can't stop them.
As 2020 approaches, there are no signs these social media-fueled protest movements are slowing down. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
As the Earth heats up, weather and climate patterns are changing dramatically around the globe. Africa felt the effects of those changes in 2019 as it dealt with cyclones, droughts, and unstoppable rains that jeopardized livelihoods. From Nairobi, Rael Ambor reports on what lies ahead for the continent.
62-year-old David Kimboi sorts out dry maize stalks on his 21-hectare farm in Kenya's Trans Nzoia County. Kimboi turns the stalks of what could have been a bountiful harvest into silage for feeding his 15 herd of cattle. He says the heavy rains that have rocked different parts of eastern Africa caused the crops to fail.
At a time of growing crops, we expected an optimum yield, like we had invested heavily in all the crops that we grew. But unfortunately, we were not able to get a good harvest out of all that, which means a lot of money was just thrown into the docks, and we didn't get anything out of that. And we do not expect to get anything elsewhere other than from this land, because we depend on rain-fed agriculture.
Trans Nzoia County, where Kimboi settled after retirement in 2017, is known for growing predominantly maize, Kenya's staple food. Apart from the excessive rain, farmers in the area have faced pests and disease challenges.
Every time we go to harvest the maize, there is rain. And this maize, when rain don't, it gets wet and it gets spoiled very quickly. That when there's adverse effects in growing of maize and also in beans. Beans, the first crop was, we didn't have any harvest at all. It all went bad because of these heavy rains.
Millions of people have been displaced as a result of widespread flooding this year across large parts of Somalia, Kenya, Uganda, South Sudan, and Ethiopia. The floods have led to hundreds of deaths. In November, South Sudan declared a state of emergency in 27 affected areas, with close to 1 million people affected. The Kenya Meteorological Department attributes the rain to an irregularity known as Indian Ocean Dipole, an oscillation of surface temperatures of the sea, which brings weather extremes to countries neighboring the Indian Ocean. Bernard Chanzu is the Deputy Director of Kenya's Meteorological Services. He says nearly all of Kenya has received above average rainfall this year.
In some stations, I can quote like Meru stations, we have seen records which are showing that what has been received is more than 200% of the long-term average. That is what is usually received in the area.
With the levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere climbing to new heights, John Recher, a scientist specializing in climate and agriculture research, says Africans can expect more extremes in years to come.
We will therefore have more effects of climate change affecting the weather patterns, specifically the rainfall patterns. The climate change will be more intense, and therefore the climate variability that is having these extreme events and of the drought and the floods will be more frequent and even more intense going into the future.
The solution for Kimboi and other farmers, according to experts like Recher, lie on adapting to climate change. That, he says, would require help from government and agencies to implement new agricultural practices such as alternative irrigation methods and efficient water storage for farmers. Raya Lumbur for VOA News, Trans Nzoia, Kenya.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, it's been a challenging year for Britain's royal family, with problems including a potential rift between Prince William and Harry, Britain's laborious effort to exit the European Union, and a scandal involving Prince Andrew and a disastrous TV interview in which he defended his friendship with sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and then failed to show empathy for Epstein's young female victims. The turmoil seemed to be reflected in Queen Elizabeth's recorded Christmas message about the need for reconciliation and forgiveness. And she said that much like Jesus' life, there are challenges we all face.
The path, of course, is not always smooth, and may at times this year have felt quite bumpy.
Given all the turmoil, there are apparently plans for some changes in the leadership at Buckingham Palace in the new year. Here to talk more about it is London-based reporter Amy Gutman. Amy, what can you tell us?
Some of these changes have been propelled by the Prince Andrew controversy, shall we say. And that's because Prince Charles, along with his father, Prince Philip, really felt very strongly that Prince Andrew needed to step down from his royal duties. He was becoming a huge distraction and a huge liability for the royal family. And it's believed that Prince Andrew has always been the favorite son of the Queen. And so there was a sense that she might not do what needed to be done, i.e. force him to step aside and sort of hang up his royal uniform, as it were. So Prince Philip had summoned Prince Charles, who was next in line to the throne, to come for a meeting to discuss how to handle the next steps. And the Queen has actually acquiesced in this case, and she had a conversation. She summoned Prince Andrew, her favorite son, to the palace and told him that he must retire from public life and that he was causing too much harm and too much reputational damage to the royal family. And so it's believed that through this process and through some pretty decisive actions, which are being lauded by the British public, by Prince Charles, he's starting to show his leadership qualities and very good judgment. He envisions a slimmed-down version of the royal family, getting rid of some of the extended family in terms of appearances and in terms of relying on the royal purse, and just a more streamlined royal family. I think he's aware that there's a greater demand for transparency, especially when it comes to financials and what's being spent, because after all, much of this is coming from the public purse.
When is this all supposed to transpire, and how big of a deal is this?
This is not necessarily a big deal. This is a very organic, natural progression. After all, the Queen is turning 95 years old in 18 months. That's the age at which her husband, Prince Philip, retired from public life. It makes total sense that she would choose to do the same thing. And 18 months is about the point at which you would hope that a succession plan would start to take shape, more than a plan, but actually a practice. And so it makes a lot of sense that Prince Charles would be much more involved in some of the decision-making and operational duties, though I must say, the Queen has not ceded to him in any way. The Queen is still in charge.
Where does this leave Prince William?
Prince William has also stepped up. Prince William supported Charles in his views about Prince Andrew, which is William's uncle, and he's also become much more respected for his views and for taking a decisive opinion about matters and not just sitting back and remaining neutral. The public has really respected the fact that Prince William has taken a stand here.
All right, that's London-based reporter Amy Gutman. Thank you for being with us. Well, we've talked a lot about Hanukkah and Christmas, and now it is the start of Kwanzaa. We hear more about that religion, or that holiday, I should say, in this report from Now This World.
In 1965, tensions between Black communities and law enforcement reached a boiling point, and Los Angeles saw the most violent urban riot in 20 years. As the Watts riots unfolded around him, LA-based PhD student and activist Molana Karenga saw an opportunity to restore unity in Black communities and foster African-American cultural institutions, values, and traditions. So in 1966, Karenga created Kwanzaa, with the purpose to help connect Black Americans to their African roots and with each other in the face of marginalization. In fact, the name Kwanzaa even comes from a Swahili phrase, Matunda ya Kwanzaa, meaning first fruits. Karenga decided that this new holiday should fall in the 7-day period between Christmas and New Year's. He even added a second A on the end of Kwanzaa to represent each of these 7 days. Each day represents a different principle: unity, self-determination, collective responsibility, cooperative economics, purpose, creativity, and faith. During Kwanzaa, Karenga wanted communities to celebrate by gathering together to light candles and to join in a huge communal feast called Kuramu, inspired by a Zulu harvest celebration. Every celebration is different, but generally, families come together to light a kinara, read poetry, and dance to traditional African songs. Karenga traveled the country spreading the word about this new holiday. It then gained momentum through schools and colleges, and pretty soon, families started adopting Kwanzaa into their yearly celebrations. At first, many African American Christians were opposed to Kwanzaa, as they didn't want it to be a replacement for Christmas. But as Kwanzaa became more popular in the late 1960s, Black churches began to embrace it, and the holiday became a supplement rather than an alternative to Christmas.
The The music world is mourning the loss of a woman known for some big hits. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
The music world is mourning the loss of a woman known for creating some big hits. Her name was Allie Willis. No one told you life was gonna be this way. And the theme from Friends was just one of her many hits. Do you remember when it was time? Earth, Wind, and Fire recorded Willis's September. And this hit, performed by Patti LaBelle for Beverly Hills Cop in 1975, won her a Grammy. Allie Willis was 72 years old. Her publicist says she died from an issue with her heart. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Eighteen-year-old Billie Eilish has shot to fame in the past year and has won a slew of awards in the process. But she's also been an outspoken in her lyrics and in the lyrics of her songs and on social media about her concerns with climate change, animal abuse, and eating meat. And she's now being honored not just for her music, but for using her platform to speak out on the issues she cares about. PETA, or People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, is recognizing Eilish for her activism at the organization's 14th annual Libby Awards with their Best Voice for Animals Award. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States is offering up to $15 million for information leading to the disruption of key financial mechanisms of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Working particularly through its Quds force, the IRGC, as it is called, is the chief Iranian institution directing and carrying out the regime's global terrorist campaign. The mechanisms include, among others, financial institutions facilitating IRGC transactions, front companies tied to the IRGC, and IRGC donors or financial facilitators. One such facilitator is financier and senior IRGC leader Abdul Reza Sholei, a commander in the IRGC Quds Force based in Sana'a, Yemen. Born in Iran circa 1957, he is also known as Haji Youssef. At a press conference, Special Representative for Iran Brian Hook noted that Sholei has a long history of attacks against Americans and our allies globally.
He planned multiple assassinations of coalition forces in Iraq, provided weapons and explosives to violent Shia extremist groups, and planned the January 20th, 2007 attack in Karbala that killed five American soldiers and wounded three others.
In 2011, Sholei directed a plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the United States, Adel Al-Jubeir, at a restaurant in Washington.
Had this scheme succeeded, as many as 200 innocent civilians in the United States could have been killed.
Special Representative Hook said that given Sholei's track record of terrorism and destabilization in Iraq, the United States remains gravely concerned by his presence in Yemen and potential role in providing advanced weaponry of the kind we have interdicted to the Houthis. Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $150 million to more than 100 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. If you have information about Abdul Reza Sholei, please contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate, or email info@rewardsforjustice.net. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.